From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Tom Waits's rock albums have earned him a devoted international following and a reputation as the poet laureate of America's underlife. But Waits has another audience that knows him for his roles in such films as Down by Law and Ironweed. On today's Fresh Air, I speak with Tom Waits about Big Time, his new concert film that combines his music and his acting. Also today, I speak with Scott Johnson, an experimental composer who wrote the soundtrack for the new movie Patty Hearst. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a reissue of the musical She Loves Me, and language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg tries to match popular songs with classical poetry, and he sings the results. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. Some of Tom Waits' songs are pretty elliptical, and I think the same can be said of his interviews. Waits is a singer, songwriter, pianist, and actor. He started recording in the 1970s in a voice that he compared to a barking dog. You might think that his raspy voice was the product of decades of too many cigarettes and whiskey. But this voice was in the body of a young man. When he was getting started, Waits lived in L.A. in his car or in a flophouse. The people he met and the stories he overheard in bars and diners became the subjects of his songs. Some of his songs sounded as if they were inspired by Jack Kerouac's recordings of poetry and jazz. The first time critic John Landau heard Waits perform, Landau said it was the best contemporary expression of the loner he'd ever encountered. For years, Waits had the persona of the down-and-out hipster. But this hipster is no longer down and out. His music earned him a cult following years ago. Now his acting in such films as The Cotton Club, Ironweed, and Down by Law has won him new audiences. His music seems to be changing as his life changes. You can hear the influence of tangos, gypsy songs, and Tin Pan Alley in his new work. Waits stars in a new performance film called Big Time, and it features him singing in several different personas. There's also a new album with songs from the film. From the album Big Time, this is Strange Weather.
Will you take me across the channel? London Bridge is falling down. Strange a woman tries to say all that a man will try to drown. And it's the rain that they predicted. It's the forecast every time. The roses died because you picked it. I believe that friend is mine. And moreover, strangers talk only about the weather. Moreover, the world, it's the same. It's the same.
That's Strange Weather from Tom Waits' new album, Big Time, which is the companion album to his new film of the same name. Tom Waits, welcome to Fresh Air.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
I think your music's really changing, changed a lot in the last few years. You've gone from, for instance, piano, saxophone, bass, and drums to arrangements with accordion, organ, violin. So you're writing songs inspired by tangos and other dancers. And I wonder what's inspired some of the changes in your music.
I don't know. I'm working with different people now.
You know what I was wondering? I was wondering if your life had changed so much in the past few years with the success that you've had both in movies and with your music, that some of the songs that you sang were no longer fitting your life the way they once did, and if it was time to write new songs, new kinds of songs.
Well, you get to an impasse as a writer, I think, and at a certain point you feel as though you need to find some new territory for yourself. I think that's natural.
What kind of impasse had you come to?
Well, just that I'd kind of stayed with a small piece of geography for some time. I'd stayed with the same producer in the studio. The last three records, last four records, I produced myself. So, you know, I started taking responsibility for all those things, which I thought was an important thing to do, and My earlier songs, I still sing some of them, but, you know, I try not to look back and, you know, that's all.
Your new film features several personas that you've developed, several characters that you do. And I was wondering if acting in films has freed you up to do different kinds of characters on stage.
Probably, yeah. You know, it's a blessing and a curse. You create a character for yourself, and then at some point, you at the same time, you feel bound and restricted and confined by the very thing that you thought was going to give you some freedom. So I guess I feel more like a conductor than a character now, that I can have more latitude, and I'm not as inhibited by myself. And so, you know, this I think it's important to, you know, to continue to grow and change. And so that's what I'm trying to do.
Was Tom Waits a character that you dreamed up to, the Tom Waits that we saw on stage?
Yeah, I guess I dream myself up. I guess everybody dreams themselves up. Yeah.
Why, when you started performing, though, did you want a persona? As opposed to being very naturalistic on stage, just being yourself.
Well, you know, you throw yourself in the bloodstream of the media and concertizing and traveling a lot. I think you need something to hide behind. You know, you can't go out there alone.
Well, in the film Big Time, there's several characters that you do. Do you want to describe any of them for our listeners who haven't seen you in concert?
Oh, my favorite's the Buddy Greco cocktail Halloween nightmare. In the white dinner jacket, in the cruise ship sequences of the film. I guess it was when I was a kid, I wanted to be an entertainer. My stepfather gave me a wild shirt. I mean, because his concept of entertainment was Vegas, baby. You know, it was sewn together with like 200 different fabrics and these big contiki buttons made out of wood, and you know, 29 different shades of green. I always got a kick out of that. I hung on to the shirt as long as I could. I've always been fascinated with those guys, the Vegas guys.
Well, you know, I should play a couple of Vegas homages that you do here. I mean, this is, I think of this as your homage to Frank Sinatra and to showbiz anthems.
A lot of people think that is Frank Sinatra.
Oh, singing on it, really?
Yeah, straight to the top. A friend of mine was in the car with his mom and put on the tape, and she went, gee, is that a new Frank Sinatra song? And she was dead serious.
Well, you know, I really like the song. I mean, it seems to me that it's more of an homage than a parody. Do you know what I mean? I think it's a good song.
Oh, why, thank you.
Do you think of that way, too? I mean, I don't read it as a parody as much as... tell me what you think.
tell you what I think about what?
About your song, Straight to the Top.
Well, it's one of those... one of those phrases that just keeps you going.
Okay,
It's like Big Time. You know, it's like you gotta have a plan in this world. You know, you gotta have some place you want to go so you know when you've arrived. And Straight to the Top is just one of those songs.
I've put together a little medley of Straight to the Top and I'll Take New York, so we can hear a little bit of both of them.
Boy, thank you.
Hey, somebody's got to put showbiz medleys together, right?
Yeah.
So let's give it a listen. And this is this is in the movie Big Time, but we're going to play it from the album Frank's Wild Years. And this is Tom Waits.
I'm going straight to the top. Whoa. I'm going where the air is fresh and clean. I'm going straight up to the top. If you know me, you know what I mean. I can't let Mr. Sorrow try and pull old Frankie down. We'll live for tomorrow. I found you straight to the top. I'm going up where the air is fresh and clean.
Tom Waits, I have to say, when you do this in the movie, there's something very Liza about it, very Liza Minnelli, like in New York, New York.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
With your arm gestures, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, I get a lot of that type of thing. People think that we're not going out anymore, but she gave me a lot.
This is a whole new side of you that that I have to say. I'm really enjoying. You like a lot of pop composers and pop singers, right? Porter, Berlin, Gershwin.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You know, all those Brill Building guys.
Yeah, yeah. And when you wrote the medley that we heard, which I should say I also think of like as an homage to Sinatra's Capitol years and then to his to his latter years. But anyways, were you living in New York then? I know you spent some time living in New York.
Yeah, it's my tribute to New York City.
Did going to New York give you a whole new set of characters and settings to write about? I should, explain that you'd been in Los Angeles writing very Los Angeles-inspired songs about bars and diners and street scenes.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have a pool here in New York, and that was a big shock to me. It was a little hard to get used to. I had to cut my staff in half. And it was really rough. But it was... I lived here for a while, and I think most of the songs on, that Rain Dogs album were inspired by living here.
Uh-huh. Have you found new qualities in your voice? I think your voice has opened up a little bit.
Well, thank you. Gosh, I don't know what to say. Yeah, I think it's maybe it has opened up a little bit. I'm a little freer with it. I can still bark like a dog. And I think most of the comparisons with Caruso are, frankly, unfair.
Well, here's my fantasy about your voice. That you initially sang hoarse because you liked it stylistically, and then you ended up with a really hoarse voice.
You mean like if you cross your eyes, they'll stay that way? when your mom says, don't turn your eyelids inside out, Bobby.
I guess not unlike that, yes. Mm-hmm. So that's my fantasy. What's the reality?
I don't know. I guess when I was a little kid, I used to try to make my voice lower. Because I wanted to grow up real fast so I could be an old man and play golf. You know, I couldn't wait to get there, wear wild slacks and drink coffee and smoke cigars and talk about finance. And it happened very, very fast. You know, when I started talking like this, you know, there I saw the clubs. They appeared in the corner of the room. And so, I don't know. I guess you get the voice you deserve.
Are you taking better care of your voice now? I read that you'd given up smoking.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really hard to do. So you
it
must have really been
to
committed to doing it.
I am committed to doing it. I drink my own urine, and I think that's...
that's enough for your voice, right?
it's not bad with a little ice and a twist.
This is the doctor's recommendation, no doubt.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I can, you know, I still have a falsetto. it's somewhere around here.
You want to demonstrate that for us?
Well, that's going to cost you.
Right, okay. All right. Well, listen, we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back and talk some more.
Okay.
Tom Waits is my guest, singer, songwriter, pianist, and actor. And he's got a new performance film called Big Time and a new album accompanying it with songs from the movie, also called Big Time. The movie's about to open. And Tom Waits is also an actor who has appeared in The Cotton Club and Down by Law and Ironweed. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Tom Waits is my guest.
We're back.
We're back. About your new performance film, let me know why you wanted to make a movie, to have a record of your performance.
I've been threatening it for a long time, and my wife finally said, well, I guess it's time we get something here that we can look at after you come back home from the road, because, you know, you rarely come home with anything that... Yeah, you get some snapshots and some reviews, but I guess it gives me a chance to capsulize some of the songs on the last three albums, and you know, it was all shot in one night, and you know, it's let's see, I don't know what to say about it.
That's okay.
It's a lot of people are comparing it to Zulu, The Pawnbroker, Mondo Kani, Gandhi.
But with a smaller cast.
Well, a lot of the larger gladiator sequences were cut out. And it gave me a chance to work with Faye Dunaway, which is always a big dream of mine.
You know, for years you lived in this hotel in Los Angeles that was a residential hotel, a cheap hotel. You lived out of your car for a while when you started performing.
Boy, you know more about me than I do.
Oh, you know, I wanted to ask you this. I was recently interviewing Paul Schrader, who wrote Taxi Driver, and he said that he was living out of his car right before he wrote the movie, and that it was the most alienating experience he could imagine, the most lonely experience. And he described living out of his car like living and driving around in an enclosed steel coffin, being out in the open but being in this steel coffin.
Mm-hmm.
I was wondering if you could compare that to your experience of living out of a car.
Well, I guess, you know, you have to park where you can find an AC outlet. That's important. And there's a lot of different, there's a great many apparatus now that you can plug into your cigarette lighter in the car, which I think has changed automotive living forever. You can get hot plates. You can even get CD players. You plug it right in there.
Yeah, that's right.
And so I don't know.
Did you have literary reasons for wanting to live that kind of life?
What kind of reasons?
Literary reasons.
I've never been to the Sudan.
But, you know, I figure you read a lot of Kerouac, and also, you know, a lot of writers, especially when they're starting out and haven't lived very much themselves, want to expose themselves to all kinds of things that will give them subject matter and that will expose them to interesting people, stories that they can tell.
Huh. Yeah, that's it.
Or maybe you were just really poor. I mean, I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Well, let's see. When I moved into the Tropicana, it was $9 a night. And when I moved out, I think it was like $40 a night. And they painted the swimming pool black, and they put a lot of kind of bamboo wallpaper up. And now it's, I don't know what it is now. I think that they tore the whole thing down. I was living in hotels so much on the road, I figured I might as well come home and live in one. I lived by myself, so it was nice to have a night clerk and get your messages and have a coffee shop nearby. So it was like having an all-purpose center right there, satisfying all my needs.
Were you actually from a middle-class family?
Yeah, I guess you'd say that, yeah.
Were they disturbed by your choice of lifestyle?
Well, I don't know. Yeah, I guess, you know, when you... I don't know, yeah, my folks split up when I was a kid, and so I don't know. You know, now I think they're used to it now, as far as what I'm doing. Yeah, they seem pretty happy with what I'm doing now.
I want to give our listeners a sense of what you were doing earlier in your career, and the kinds of stories and songs that you would do based on what you'd seen in diners and in bars. This is from an early album of yours called Nighthawks at the Diner.
Mm. I was always kind of one who'd like to consider myself kind of a pioneer of the palate. Restaurateur, if you will. I've wined, dined, sipped, and supped in some of the most demonstrably Beamer epitomable bistros in the Los Angeles metropolitan region. Yeah, I've had strange looking patty melts at Norm's. I've had dangerous veal cutlets at the Copper Penny. Well, what you get is a breaded Salisbury steak and a shake and bake and topped with a provocative sauce of Velveeta and half and half. Smothered with Campbell's tomato soup. See, I had kind of a, I ordered my veal cutlet, Christ, it left the plate and it walked down the end of the counter. Waitress named Irie, boy, she wearing those rhinestone glasses with a little pearl thing clip on a sweater. My veal cutlet come down, try to beat the shit out of my cup of coffee, but coffee just wasn't strong enough to defend itself.
Which is just an example of something from one of your earlier records from Nighthawks at the Diner. You made a joke earlier about working with Faye Dunaway. You didn't get to work with her, but you did work with Jack Nicholson in the film Ironweed, where you both played hobos.
Mm-hmm.
You've actually told a lot of hobo stories in your career, and you've lived on the road and in your car and in vagrant hotels. Did you have any things to pass on to him about what you'd seen?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got along real well with Jack. I liked him very much, and he's a great storyteller. He should run for office. Yeah, I was real thrilled to meet him.
Now that you're probably staying at Hilton's and Sheraton's instead of instead of SROs,
but of course,
do you feel
the finest?
Do you feel at all removed from the material you started writing?
Completely.
Seriously?
No. Removed from my songs, you mean, and my stories?
Yeah, and from the original source of the songs and the stories.
No, I don't feel removed from stories at all. I guess one thing about stories and jokes and rumors and gossip will always move just ahead of the media. I enjoy that whole folk process. That you also find in music as well, how ideas develop and travel and change, and how mutant musical ideas find each other and join up. Did that answer your question?
Not really.
No, I didn't think
since
so.
Since you asked. I want to ask you about one more of your songs, which we're going to end with, and this is a song called Rain Dogs that's in Big Time and on the new record Big Time. And one of the things I really like about this song is the way the anniversary waltz weaves in and out of it. Tell me about writing it.
Oh, the anniversary waltz? Oh, my father-in-law sang that to Kathleen and I after we got married, and on the telephone.
I have one last question. You once said that talking to the media is a lot like talking to the cops. It seems to me you still feel that way. Do you?
Hey, no offense. I love cops.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay.
And my guest has been singer-songwriter, pianist, and actor Tom Waits. And his new performance film is called Big Time. It's about to open. And there's also a new album called Big Time featuring songs from the movie. And we're going to hear one of those songs in just a second. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. And on our next show, I'll speak with Paul Krasner, who was one of the fathers of the Underground Press. 30 years ago, he began publishing The Realist, a magazine which combined satire and radical journalism, and eventually became a forum for 60s political counterculture. Krasner now observes the American social and political scene as a stand-up comic. I hope you can join us. Here's more from Tom Waits.
Inside a broken clock, splash the wine with all the wind.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A schizophrenic sense of unease is how director Paul Schrader describes the mood of the soundtrack to his new film, Patty Hearst. Coming up, I speak with the composer, Scott Johnson, about writing his first film score. Also today, classical music critic Lord Schwartz reviews a reissue of the cast recording of She Loves Me. It's a Broadway musical by Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock, the same team who wrote Fiddler on the Roof and Fiorello. And language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg plays Settings. It's a parlor game popular among linguists in which you try to match the words of a famous poem to a popular song. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Dale Willman. The Senate is still debating a bill to grant unpaid parental leave for infant and medical care, but senators unanimously passed an amendment to that bill today that is tough on child pornography. The measure would outlaw the sale of child pornography, its distribution via computer, and its broadcast over cable TV. While advocating the anti-porn intent of the bill, many senators questioned its constitutionality, since it appears to broaden the government's ability to censor and police individuals. Space Shuttle Discovery has been cleared for launch tomorrow morning following what's been a 2.5-year American space drought, and even the weather is looking good for a launch. NASA Shuttle Administrator Rear Admiral Richard Truly says the 5-man shuttle crew is elated to be heading into space, but he also cautioned today that there's always the possibility of another Challenger-style accident.
It is inevitable. It's in the cards. It's for the same reason that when we fly airliners, airplanes, carrier aircraft all over the world, there are chains of events that eventually result in accidents.
If the weather holds, the redesigned shuttle is scheduled to blast off at 9:59 a.m. Eastern Time. President Reagan has accepted the resignation of James Miller, director of the White House Office of Management and Budget. The president today announced that Miller is leaving the administration for a job in the private sector. Mr. Reagan praised Miller's role in working to bring down the federal budget deficit and to eliminate excessive regulation. Miller will be replaced by OMB Deputy Director Joe Wright. Soviet leaders have called a special meeting this Friday to reorganize the Communist Party, that according to Foreign Ministry spokesman Gennady Gerasimov. Members of the Central Committee have been summoned to Moscow, including Foreign Minister Edvard Shevardnadze, who has cut short his visit to the United Nations. More from NPR's Ted Clark.
The abruptness with which Shevardnadze was recalled leads some analysts to believe that a leadership crisis may be underway in Moscow. Dmitry Symes is with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
I am convinced that there is a real leadership crisis, because otherwise they would not send this alarm signal and create grand confusion in the West about Mr. Gorbachev's political standing.
Soviet spokesman Gennady Gerasimov in New York with Foreign Minister Shevardnadze today said the meeting will be devoted to the reorganization of the party apparatus, including the Central Committee itself. Shevardnadze had planned to stay in New York through the weekend, and he had planned many meetings. He juggled his schedule to fit in as many of those meetings as possible before his departure tonight. Meanwhile, Gorbachev appeared relaxed and smiling on Soviet television today as he met with East German leader Erich Honecker in Moscow. He told Honecker he was determined to press ahead with his internal reforms known as perestroika. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
Afghan rebels launched a rocket attack on Kabul today, firing more than 20 missiles into the Afghan capital. The Soviet TASS news agency says one missile exploded near a bus depot, killing at least 33 people and wounding more than 150. The attack was denounced as a crime against the Afghan people. Police in Seoul, South Korea today tightened already stringent security at the Summer Olympic Games. Growing anti-American sentiment combined with threats of disruption by radical Korean students led to that heightened vigil. Protesters demanding the release of a jailed student leader hurled rocks and firebombs at police today at two colleges in Seoul. Students later threatened to attack Olympic events, including the men's marathon, on Sunday. Convicted cocaine seller John Zaccaro Jr. ended his jail term today, 30 days early. He had served 90 days under house arrest in a Burlington, Vermont apartment equipped with color TV and maid service. Zaccaro's parents, former vice presidential nominee Geraldine Ferraro and John Zaccaro Sr., picked up their son at the Burlington Probation Center to take him back to their home in New York City. You're listening to National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Film versions of great Broadway musicals, or Broadway versions of great films, rarely work as well as the originals they're based on. But classical music critic Lord Schwartz says the musical She Loves Me was an exception, despite the fact that it ran for less than a year after opening on Broadway in 1963. Lloyd has a review of the recent reissue of the long-out-of-print original cast recording.
Good morning.
Good day.
How are you this glorious day? Have you seen a lovelier morning?
Never.
It's too nice a day to be inside shuffling soap. I have no more energy whatsoever. Does anybody mind if I take the day off? Arpad, why aren't you old enough to take me away from all this?
I'm old enough.
Then marry me and I'll quit my job. Well, I guess you're really not quite old enough.
I never saw She Loves Me, but a few years after it closed, I picked up a copy of the original cast album at a cutout sale, and I immediately fell in love with it. It was the show that songwriters Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock finished 4 years after their Pulitzer Prize-winning Fiorello and just before their biggest hit, Fiddler on the Roof. It was produced by hitmaker Hal Prince, the first musical which he also chose to direct. Starring in it were some of the most appealing and original young Broadway personalities, Barbara Cook, Daniel Massey, Barbara Baxley, and Jack Cassidy, along with the veteran Hollywood actor Ludwig Donat. She Loves Me is based on an endearing movie, Ernst Lubitsch's touching 1940 comedy, The Shop Around the Corner, starring James Stewart and Margaret Sullivan as two bickering shop clerks in pre-war Budapest who haven't yet discovered that the secret romantic correspondence they are conducting is with each other. The ingratiating Broadway cast is good enough to make all their characters their own. Invidious comparisons are irrelevant.
I don't know his name or what he looks like, but I have a much more certain guide. I can tell exactly what he looks like inside. When I undertook this correspondence, little did I know I'd grow so fond. Little did I know our views would so correspond.
The success of the score is partly a result of the way the show is put together. Instead of the usual method of creating a libretto, injecting musical numbers into a scenario, She Loves Me actually started with a full script, a play by Joe Masteroff based on both the Lubitsch film script and the 1937 play by Miklos Laszlo that the movie was based on. So the musical numbers are uncommonly well integrated. The tunes and lyrics are always at the service of character and atmosphere. Perhaps you can appreciate the witty subtleties of the score even better on a recording than in a theater. Here's part of a delightful number called Sounds While Selling, in which the voices of clerks and customers blend in a comic collage of sales talk.
Good day, madam. May I help you?
Good day, madam. May I help you?
Good day, madam. May I help you?
I would like to see a
face like yours.
Cracked.
But we carry.
Do you have a cream for
cherry red skin?
Oh, I see what you mean.
You will look enchanting.
Prime lips.
Glamorous as Garbo.
Big
mouth.
I would recommend a
bath
today.
On sale, did you say?
Put a little lipstick
on your nose
twice.
Morning and evening.
And a little brush for
combing my
teeth.
Absolutely.
Wrap it up and send it. Thank you so much.
Is there something else before you go?
Yes.
Even the overture has a combination of humor and affection, the Lubitsch touch. The CD was lovingly produced by Polydor's Larry Lash, who includes interviews he conducted with members of the original show and evocative color photographs of the original production. There's even a note indicating that you might program your CD player to repeat the brief Thank You, Madam chorus, which reappears in the show, but not on the album, every time a character makes a sale. With its Eastern European setting and music box tunes, its lilting waltzes and tangos, She Loves Me has the texture and refinement of a classic operetta.
Young, strong, oh, I was something in days gone by. With some girl who just happened to catch my eye. Slim, straight, light on my feet, shoes just skimming the ground. One, two, three, one, two, three, follow the beat. Around, around, around. All night circling the floor till dawn lit up the sky. No one younger than I in days gone by.
A friend of mine has a saying that goes, when all else fails, try quality. She Loves Me began with quality. It wasn't the greatest commercial success, but it didn't fail either. It did everything it wanted to. In its quiet way, it's a landmark musical, and this CD ensures that it won't be forgotten.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed the original cast recording of She Loves Me, recently reissued on the Polydor label.
She loves me, and to my amazement, I love it, knowing that she loves me. She loves me, true, she doesn't show it. How could she, when she doesn't know it? Yesterday she loathed me, bah, now today she likes me, ha, and tomorrow, tomorrow.
This is Fresh Air. When director Paul Schrader was planning the music for his new film about the 1974 kidnapping of newspaper heiress Patty Hearst, he made the unusual decision not to use music from the period. He thought hits from the 70s would evoke the audience's memories of the time instead of Patty Hearst's. Schrader hired electric guitarist and experimental composer Scott Johnson to create a score that would express what Patty Hearst couldn't, her psychological state of mind. The score became an important element in creating the mood of the film. Let's talk about the opening piece, and this is basically the credit sequence. The music, the percussion really suggests fear and violence. And then you use the voice of Natasha Richardson, who plays Patty Hearst. You use elements from different narrations in the film. Tell us how you chose the spoken parts from the Patty Hearst character to use within the music.
Well, for the most part, I took sentences from her first communique from the SLA. And then I also went through the film, found phrases that are musically interesting to me. And then out of that pile of chosen, bits of source material, I assemble a musical texture.
I found that with the score from Patty Hearst that I could play, especially that opening sequence, I could play it over and over again like a pop record, and that it started to work on me like a pop record, that I started hearing the actress playing Patty Hearst saying, "Mom, Dad, Mom, Dad." It started to sound like a lyric to me. It started...
it was
so catchy, it started like popping up in my head occasionally the way a song will.
Well, it was written as a song. I mean, actually, that's one thing about these pieces. On the one hand, there is the, you know, any, the repetition of any word, of anything in a piece of music will do that to you. Also, in setting the various sentences, I treated them as if, you know, as I said, I analyzed the melodies that were implied in what she was saying, and I set them to music just as if it was a song.
In the film, Patty Hearst is really caught between two worlds, one world being the world of her parents, the world of privilege and comfort, and the other world being the world of the SLA, like half-crazy people in their own kind of paranoid political vision of the world. Your music, I think, captures that sense of two worlds in collision. In some of the music, for instance, there's violins, perhaps a string quartet, playing fairly placid music above really tumultuous percussion and guitar.
Well, see, this was something that just happened to turn out right. Before ever hearing about this film, I've always been interested in a blend of a European classical influences and American vernacular music. And basically, walking into this film, these two concerns worked out just perfectly, in the sense that in the context of this film, the classical aspects of it, the string playing in particular, suggests an upper class ambiance, and the American more percussion oriented elements suggest, you know, popular culture, suggest maybe the culture that the SLA came from.
You've been combining elements of classical music and rock music for years now. Did at one time those two musics seem unbridgeable to you?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, about the time Patty was getting kidnapped, I was having a big problem. I would go to music theory courses in the week, and on the weekends I would go play in the local blues club. And at one point, when I moved to New York, I simply decided I can't solve this, I'm going to stop doing music. That lasted about a year and a half. But what I would like to do is reestablish the equation that I think is the sane equation, a sane relationship between art, music, and popular music. They should interact.
I want to play something from one of your earlier records, from John Somebody, in which you used the voice, the spoken voice, as an element of the music.
You know who's in New York? Remember that guy, John somebody?
Listening to that music over and over, I really started to think about how musical the voice really is. And I think for me, the voice sounds most like that when I'm overhearing it, when I'm not really paying attention to what someone's saying, but when they're, for instance, sitting at another table, and it's kind of half drifting over to me,
mm-hmm.
and you're hearing the sound and the rhythm, and you're not really listening to the context.
Exactly. Oftentimes, the best fragments to use are moments when people are, for instance, nervousness works very well. if people stutter a little bit, the pitch of their voice will dip up and down in a sort of nervous way that often will make the best melodies. At the other end of the emotional scale, a sense of calm often will produce a pedal tone. The perfect example of that is listening to a newscaster. They will always come to rest at a certain pitch. They will end their sentences down there. And the more nervous flights of voice placed above that will immediately begin to sound like melodies.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Patty Hearst is your first film score.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you learned new things about music, having to write music to fit a narrative film?
Well, not about music per se. I did learn about how music works in a film. I really value a certain density, a thick texture, a lot of overlapping signals, a lot of things that really have to be attended to very carefully, or you just miss them. And this is, in many cases, the opposite of what's needed in a film, because people want to follow the drama. They want to hear what the actors are saying, and the music in a situation where there's a lot of dialogue has to become a sort of a murmur, almost a sort of emotional wallpaper, practically. And I found that very difficult.
Okay. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay, thanks.
Scott Johnson's score for the new film Patty Hearst is on Nonesuch Records. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with co-host Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Jerry. How are you?
Anything new at the Olympics?
Yes, we have a report that NBC, that's the network that's televising the Olympic Games, of course, is running into such opposition from South Koreans to coverage. You know, they feel that they've been it's been too negative about Korea. They're actually telling their staff, not to show the peacock out there around Seoul. We also, consider the cataclysm last night, the defeat of the U.S. men's basketball team by the Soviet Union. We talked with journalist David Halberstam about that.
He wrote a book about basketball, didn't he?
He did, indeed. He also wrote a book about how the American car industry went into decline with respect to the Japanese. So from two angles, we think he may understand this one.
Okay, well, thanks, Robert. Those stories and more are coming up in All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Like music, poetry has rhythm. Language commentator Jeffrey Nunberg has been amusing himself lately by bringing the two arts together.
I never fully appreciated the art of setting poetry to music until about 10 years ago, when a bunch of us linguists cooked up the game of settings. The object was to find a popular song to which you could set the words of a well-known poem. The more ludicrous the match, the better. The original impetus for the game was the poet John Chardy's inspired observation that Robert Frost's poem Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening could be set perfectly to the tune of Hernando's Hideaway from Damn Yankees. You'll have to bear with me a little here. Whose woods these are, I think I know. His house is in the village, though. He will not see me stopping here to watch his woods fill up with snow. Stopping by Woods on a Snowy Evening isn't too hard to find settings for, since it's written in iambic tetrameter, which happens to be the rhythm of a number of songs, ta-tum, 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 ta-tum. Another meter that works pretty well is trochaic tetrameter, tum-ta, 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 as in Longfellow's Hiawatha, or in Tennyson's Locksley Hall, which begins with Comrades, leave me here a little while as yet 'tis early morn. You can set this one to the Ode to Joy from Beethoven's Ninth, if you like. Comrades, leave me here a little while, as yet 'tis early morn. Leave me here, and when you want me, sound upon the bugle horn. But that's sort of cheating, since the Ode to Joy was originally the setting of a poem by Schiller anyway. Besides, if you're looking for something a little more up-tempo, you could try My Darling Clementine. Comrades, leave me here a little while, as yet 'tis early morn. Leave me here, and when you want me, sound upon the bugle horn. But the real challenge of the game is to find settings for iambic pentameter, ta-tum, 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 as in everything, but take, for example, a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou. It is by far the most common meter in English poetry, and yet there are precious few popular songs that have that beat. There's an obvious reason, with the odd exception like Dave Brubeck, few popular musicians have played around much with lines that have five stresses. But that makes it all the more satisfying when you do stumble on a song that works as iambic pentameter. That Old Black Magic is one, and another is the Clover's Love Potion number 9. A book of verses underneath the bough, a loaf of bread, a jug of wine, and thou, and so on. But by far the happiest of happenstance settings for iambic pentameter is that old standby Finiculi Finicula. In fact, the tune seems ready-made for Hamlet's soliloquy on suicide. To be or not to be, that is the question, Finiculi Finicula. Whether 'tis nobler in the mind to suffer, Finiculi Finicula, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, and so on. As it happens, there aren't many serious musical settings of English iambic pentameter either. But by way of compensation for the last few minutes, let me leave you with John Dowland's 1612 setting of John Lilly's lines, My Heart and Tongue Were Twins at Once Conceived, as performed by Emma Kirkby and the Consort of Music on a 1980 Decca recording.